This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the aftermath of the Great Depression, the Works Progress Administration, or WPA, commissioned hundreds of people to interview Americans and record their stories as part of the Federal Writers Project. In the 1930s, many of those interviews had been slaves. They and others remembered life in the South under slavery and the dawn of the Jim Crow South which followed. The WPA collection remains one of the largest surviving collections of first-person testimony on slavery. Yet the circumstances under which the interviews were collected gives many researchers pause and prompted Rebecca Onion to ask about the role that racism played. Rebecca is Slate staff writer covering new historical research, and she wrote about the collection of slave narratives for Slate. Rebecca, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Could you give us some background on why these narratives were even being collected as part of the WPA project?
Well, there was a sort of a push to collect folklore in general and sort of testimonies about life in the South. And so on one level, one of the things that people within the WPA, the Federal Writers Project, were trying to do was to sort of catalog American life. So there was a series of guidebooks to different American states, you know, the kind of food that was popular there, where you could go, these kinds of things. So sort of like a patriotic approach to describing American life and writing about it. And so they tap unemployed writers and artists to sort of carry out these projects. And that way, interviewing ex-slaves fit into that kind of project.
So this is a huge volume, 2,300 oral histories of elderly ex-slaves, but not considered to be sound research by all scholars. Why not?
It's been a matter of debate among historians, and I'd say it's still a really active debate. And I should say that the main sort of book that I'm looking at in this piece is written by a historian named Catherine Stewart, and the book is called Long Past Slavery. And she's sort of intervening in this longstanding debate among historians about how much we can sort of trust or rely on these narratives for actual stories of the history of slavery. And the main point of debate has been that a lot of the interviewers that were carrying out these interviews were not only white, but also in some cases, descendants of the same slaveholders that had held those interviewees, or active members of the Daughters of the Confederacy. So at the time that interviews were being carried out, there was sort of resurgence of this idea of the lost cause. So in the same decade, the Gone with the Wind movie came out and people really loved it. This idea that, you know, the Confederacy was sort of like a romantic, doomed endeavor that, you know, people sort of really like to romanticize. And some of the interviewers were sort of participating in this same set of ideological concepts. And so they went into the interviews sort of looking for, you know, expressions of fealty from the ex-slaves, you know, oh, this wasn't so bad. My slaveholder was good to me. He didn't beat me, these kinds of things. And so these expectations in some cases did translate into the ex-slaves sort of partially giving the interviewers what they wanted. And so that sort of situation has long caused historians to wonder. We have to read between the lines, basically.
Well, some of the interviewers were African-American, including quite famously Zora Neale Hurston. So do you think those who were in charge of the project were conscious that they may get different answers? I mean, was that even part of the thinking then?
Well, I mean, it was all sort of tainted by the racism of the era. What I really love about Catherine Stewart's book is that she looks at the way the interviews were commissioned and edited. So she's looking at the production process, you know, the drafts that go back and forth between people at the state level who are editing, people at the federal level who are sort of asking for more and more. And she finds that some of the editors, you know, the sort of the white editors who are maybe a little bit more sort of aligned with this lost cause ideology, a little bit more sort of fixated on drawing out these particular kind of reminiscences that would put the Confederacy in a good light, did ask, we don't want to hear as much about cruelty. We want to hear more about folklore. We want to hear about, you know, ghost stories or the kinds of everyday life things that people did on the plantation that are like a little bit more colorful, kind of less controversial. And on the other hand, the Black interviewers and the Black editors would sort of manage to get these stories of cruelty, of whippings, stories about how happy and excited enslaved people were when emancipation came, these kinds of tales that were not as kind to the Confederacy. They did manage to sneak some of those in.
Can you give us some specific examples of how these interviews kind of ran, or how those conducted by white writers as opposed to African American writers might differ?
There would be with some of these white interviewers, and I don't want to, say every single one was this way, but maybe especially with the ones that Catherine Stewart looks at, who were daughters of the Confederacy and sort of allied to this idea, there would be a sort of an underlying concept of the interviewee as sort of funny or humorous or guileless or sort of like an object of fun in this way that people were really used to at that time from reading stories like the Uncle Remus stories or some of the plantation fiction that had Black people, slaves as sort of these funny, like humorous characters. And so the way that the white interviewer might sort of enter the person's home, there was much less sort of consideration of the interviewee as sort of a dignified person who might have something really concrete to say.
We're speaking with Rebecca Onion, who writes for Slate about the WPA's collection of narratives from former slaves. This is a huge body of work, but also one tainted, as so many parts of American historical research are, and American history, by racism. So we get this picture from these narratives of, as you mentioned, the sort of grand, glorified South, when things were peaceful and happy, but also post-Civil War America. I mean, there was a lot of transformation going on in American history in the 20s and 30s. How was that reflected in these slave narratives?
Doing research for this piece, I read a really interesting article by another historian who wrote that she thought the WPA narratives were sort of most, not most telling, but she thought they were a sort of an underutilized source for understanding how elderly Black people in the South were weathering the Depression. So she would look at the WPA narratives for instances of the descriptions of poverty and or, sort of descriptions that the people would give about how they were, relying on their family, or maybe their family had migrated so they couldn't rely on them, the sort of interactions they had with the government, in relationship to getting relief or getting, some kind of payment or food support. So there's a lot of sort of, if you're not talking necessarily about the times of slavery, which granted is sort of what a lot of maybe especially the white WPA writers wanted to focus on, there's a lot of sort of ways to read these narratives to find out what it was like to be usually impoverished Black person in Jim Crow South and to be elderly and to not have much support.
But there was also some sense of mourning for those who'd moved north during the Great Migration. The quote unquote, the old time Negro is passing on. What was behind that?
So this is what you're referring to is a sort of a from the early 20th century until, the 1930s and 1940s, this is a sense of nostalgia on the part of white people, I should say, for a perceived past when the racial order was, maybe more comprehensible to them or made more sense or whatever it was. And it sort of came out in these expressions of sadness that, an older kind of, well, they would say Negro was no longer to be found in the South. And as you say, this is related to the Great Migration. There's a economic loss for white landholders in the South when a lot of the labor starts going north. So that's sort of underlying it in a way. But it gets expressed in this way where it comes out as white writers saying, we're just losing so much in terms of folklore, in terms of the old stories, in terms of the old ways, when in reality it's also, a deeply political thing to say.
This methodology has been questioned for some time, but how about today, Rebecca? I mean, when differences between racial perspectives is so often acute, do white interviewers get a different story than African American interviewers?
That is a huge question. I would have to guess yes. I mean, I don't know what data set I would use to answer that. You'd have to do sort of a careful analysis, the same way that Catherine Stewart has done here, to find that out. One thing that really resonated with me in her book that had to do with the idea of, they used to call it a Negro bias, this idea among some of the white editors or the white controllers of this project that the Black interviewers and the Black interviewees could not be trusted to produce some kind of truth because they were sort of inherently biased towards their own race, or they were overly emotional, or whatever it was. And it really resonated with me because of a month and a half ago, Donald Trump coming out and saying, I don't believe that the judge in my Trump University case can judge my case correctly because he has Hispanic heritage, which kind of taps this really, really old idea about bias and testimony.
Well, there are several examples in your article that you pull from Catherine Stewart's book about the differences in the kind of answers that the African American and the white interviewers got. One of them really struck me. This is about emancipation specifically. Can you tell us a little bit about it? I think it was a pair of interviewees, Sam and Louisa Everett.
Yes, a married couple, the Everetts, who were interviewed by Pearl Randolph. And you can hear actually in the excerpt that I'm about to read, the sort of the way that Randolph wrote up their testimony, which is in third person and again, like a sort of academic English. And so the Everetts told Randolph about the reaction that their slaveholder had when news of emancipation came to the plantation, where there still were a number of people being held in bondage despite being pretty late in the war. And basically, they reported to Randolph that Big Jim kind of went off the rails. So Randolph writes, Big Jim stood weeping on the piazza and cursing the fate that had been so cruel to him by robbing him of all of his, well, he uses an objectionable term, N words. He inquired if any wanted to remain until all the crops were harvested. And when no one consented to do so, he flew into a rage. Seizing his pistol, he began firing into the crowd of frightened Negroes. Some were killed outright, and others were maimed for life. Finally, he was prevailed upon to stop. He then attempted to take his own life. So there's this persistent myth in Lost Cause ideology that at emancipation, a number of ex-slaves just stayed on the plantation because they were so loyal and they just loved their situation so much that they didn't want to leave. And a story like this, well, highlights a couple of things, one of which is the volatility of that situation where the people who'd just been emancipated had so little protection. They had each other, but who else might be there to, help them deal with this situation where the person who's had so much control over their lives has just basically gone completely out of control and, started killing some of them. And so the Randolphs say later on in their narrative, some of the ex-slaves basically persuaded him to stop by saying, okay, we'll stay. And so this sort of gives this counter story to what the prevailing white story was about emancipation, which is to say, this was a really dangerous time and things happened that, might not ever have been reported if it wasn't for someone interviewing people who had been there to see it.
Yeah, pretty powerful stuff. Rebecca, just an absolutely illuminating article. Thank you so much for speaking with us about it.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Rebecca Onion is a Slate staff writer covering new historical research, and that's where she wrote about the WPA's collection of narratives from former slaves. You can find a link to read that article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org, as well as a link to the History of American Slavery podcast series that Rebecca hosted with Jamel Bowie. All that, again, wordofmouthradio.org. Our last word today comes from the Daily Dot, reporting.